Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Dr. Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club, and I'd like to welcome our listeners on the radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished visitors, our distinguished guests, who will be discussing the subject of so-called rogue states and weapons of mass destruction. This has been a week of great significance in the area of proliferation of nuclear weapons, as on Sunday evening or Monday morning, depending on where you are in the world, the North Koreans apparently tested a small-yield nuclear weapon underground. Since then, there's been much debate about what led to this. Was it or was it not a nuclear weapon? Is it the precursor to further steps towards a deployed nuclear weapons capability by the North Koreans? What action should the UN take? Should there be sanctions? Were there mistakes on the part of the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, that led to this? So there are a myriad number of questions that arise from this. We have two terrific experts here to discuss this with us. To my immediate left is Dr. Amy Sands. She is the provost of the Monterey Institute of International Studies. Prior to that, she served at the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency in the United States government as associate director of the Bureau of Intelligence Verification and Information Systems.
Management.
Information management. I always get that wrong. IVI. Prior to that, Dr. Sands was on the staff at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, and she's particularly an expert on verification of intelligence and verification of activities in the weapons of mass destruction area. How do we know what other countries are doing in this area? Her left is Dr. Philip Yun, and I don't have the biographical information here. So, Philip, tell us your current title at the Asia Foundation.
Currently the Vice President for Resource Development at the Asia Foundation. And the reason I guess I'm here was because from 1994 to 2001, I worked at the U.S. Department of State as a appointee, dealing mostly in the East Asia Pacific Bureau in the last 3 years, predominantly with North Korea. And I accompanied William Perry, who was then the North Korea policy coordinator, as well as Madeleine Albright on their respective trips to North Korea.
And your title during that period of time was U.S. Coordinator for North Korea Policy.
One of the senior advisor to coordinator.
So let's just dive right in. Was this a nuclear test in North Korea? Could it have been a conventional weapon, and conventional explosives exploded underground to simulate a nuclear weapon?
Well, I'll start. I find it highly unlikely that it was somehow a fake nuclear weapons test. It just seems like it would be a very risky approach for the North Koreans to take at this point. It is possible, and I can't say that I'm a scientist with great expertise in this area, although I have had to look at verification regimes for comprehensive test ban treaty. And it is true that mining explosions, for example, can look very much like a nuclear test. But if you get very good information from regional monitors, seismic monitors, you should be able to tell the difference. And I'm pretty convinced that in the long run, they're going to be able to say for sure that it was a small nuclear weapons test. And if you think about the North Korean, what they were trying to achieve with this event, I don't think it would serve their purpose to be trying to do something that turned out to be a fake. It would actually undermine them to such a degree that it would be worse than even having what might be perceived as, by some, as a failed nuclear test, which I don't think we can say that either.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if it turns out to be not a nuclear test. I think that people are trying to decide right now whether, in fact, it is, and there's some questions about it. Some folks believe, I think the Russians were talking about 5 to 15 kilotons. Others were talking about much smaller. I think the South Koreans were talking about 550 tons. I think that'll all sort itself out. And I think for the reasons that Amy had talked about, the North Koreans have touted this for quite a while about their nuclear capability. And for this to be a ruse, I think, would be just incredibly damaging to them. One of the things that we have found out, particularly over the last few years, is that the North Koreans basically are going to do what they say they're going to do. And in fact, for quite a while, they told us that the missile moratorium was something that they were no longer going to abide by. They gave us plenty of notice. And then they said they were going to test. And in fact, they did test. And I think in the same way, they did the same thing with the nuclear test as well.
What do you think is the intention of the North Koreans in testing a nuclear weapon or pursuing a nuclear weapons program in general? What do they hope to gain?
One can't discount the fact that probably back in, they're hoping at some point that they can prevail over the Korean Peninsula. I think you just can't discount that. That will always be there. But realistically, North Korea at this point is a failed state. And I think their main motivation at this point is really regime survival. They are insecure for a variety of reasons. They think everyone is out to get them. And things haven't gone well internally, both economically. They're having troubles, of course. They have trouble right now keeping their population within their borders because they want to leave. So there's some internal pressures, I think, facing the regime at this point in time. And so one of the things that I remember when I was in negotiations with the North Koreans as well is that in a hostile world in which they view exists towards them, they kept on talking about how they did not want to become another Yugoslavia or another Iraq, and they were referring to the Gulf War in 1991. And they kept on repeating themselves to us in these negotiations that if they had a nuclear device, that the outcomes would have been different in those two circumstances. And I think that's something that we cannot discount. And again, I firmly believe that when you're dealing with an adversary, you have to listen to them. You have to hear what they say and not discount what they say. And that's what we heard.
I would completely agree with Philip. The motivations for most countries who seek nuclear weapons has usually something to do with either their sense of insecurity, their security needs in general. They're sort of looking for some type of status or prestige in the international community, or oftentimes it can also have something to do with the power game or structure in either the region they're in or even internally, what power structure is going on. I think each one of these in its own way could fit what has probably happened in the North Korean situation. But the other point to recognize is that the lesson that people, the countries seem to learn from Iraq, whether it was the first war or the second one, was if you have a nuclear weapon and you prove that you have it, that the U.S. is less likely to deal with you militarily, that they just that option is much less attractive or easily accomplished. And I have had one expert in the field, Gary Seymour, indicate that he thought one of the reasons they had this test or might test, because this was before they actually had tested, was to take the issue of disarmament off the table, that they were concerned that all the discussions the U.S. always talks about, disarming and denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula, and they wanted to remove that as an option almost and be equals with the United States at the negotiating table. I'd be actually curious if Philip, who has a lot more depth of expertise, thought that might be a driving force here.
I think that having nuclear weapons is something. I mean, one of the things they also are looking for in the various hierarchy besides security is basically being treated as an equal with the United States. I don't think there's any question about that. And so, you know, the way I look at disarmament, though, is it sort of presupposes that you accept that they have nuclear weapons, and then you can sort of move forward. So in certain ways, I'm wondering if North Korea, and it's still open to question all whether or not they're willing to give those up, and I think it's going to be increasingly harder to do that. But when you start with a disarmament sort of paradigm, at least you're accepting the fact that nuclear weapons are part of your arsenal. And so I'm not sure what Gary means by that. I also think that as we thought about it, given all that's going on for the United States and all that's on its plate, North Korea had a tendency to get sort of pushed on the wayside to some degree. And I think it's an indication. I don't think one can discount the I don't want to say gamesmanship, but the negotiations that are going on here. It's one in which to say, you need to pay attention to us and you need to take us seriously.
Another interesting explanation I've heard over the past week is that the choice of a nuclear weapon is an economic choice for North Korea. We're all familiar with the history of U.S. defense policy over the last 40 or 50 years, where, in fact, during the Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson administrations, choices were made to move towards nuclear deterrence, partly because it was a more economical way, was regarded as more economical to address our security needs than conventional forces, which are more expensive to keep in the field and maintain a large army and so on. Someone I heard say that it might have been a similar decision on the part of North Korea, which is very stretched financially. And, one nuclear weapon or a few nuclear weapons could do the job in deterring anyone who wanted to attack North Korea or threaten North Korea or prevent North Korea from doing what it wanted to do, as opposed to legions of military men and armor and so on.
Well, I think that's also that has to be a factor. In certain ways, you can say more bang for the buck. It's much more efficient. I remember one of the SINCPACs, the commander in chief of the Pacific Fleet, said that he had toured the DMZ. He had talked to his counterparts in China, and they were kicking the tires around in terms of what the armaments look like. And while there's plenty of firepower on the other side, on the northern side of the DMZ, it was all infrastructure that ultimately would start decaying. And given the lack of industrial output that exists in North Korea and how difficult straits they are economically, there was concern that they weren't going to be able to sustain this over a long period of time. So I think that In fact, that is part of it. I think also, if you look at just the manpower, the military people there. I mean, I remember when I was in North Korea, what I was struck by was really how small the North Korean soldiers were in presumably prestigious areas in which a lot of foreigners would see them. They must have been 5 feet 5 inches, 130, 135 pounds. And what I was also struck by was immediately going from North Korea to South Korea and then coming out of an Air Force base in South Korea and seeing these Korean soldiers who are basically over 6 feet tall. So that's got to also play into some of psychologically, at least, what's going on in North Korea as well.
So how do you think the Bush administration is handling this event that has occurred?
Well, I think they're probably doing as much as they can at the moment. I think they've done a pretty poor job of handling the North Korean situation since the day they took office. So they have had this on-again, off-again approach to North Korea where, on the one hand, they talk about wanting to find a resolution to the problem, and in this case, they want to work multilaterally in the six-party context. On the other hand, they talk about the leader with almost no respect. They talk about regime change. It's very hard to sit across from a negotiating table and convince the person on the other side who heard you give a speech the week before about regime change to think he should trust you when he says, but don't worry, we don't have any hostile intent towards you. So I think the mixed signals and the not sustained really effort at trying to engage the North Koreans has really been problematic and caused some of the reaction by the North Koreans, who are looking for ways to keep in our radar, basically, in a very significant way. This week, since the actual test has happened, they have probably done the right things, which is try to go through the United Nations Security Council and get a pretty tough resolution with I'm concerned about is they're going to look for very tough sanctions without sort of offering the other side of it, which is trying to talk about some sort of what they call smart sanctions, where they really target it to the missile and nuclear programs and certain things that could facilitate that type of development, but then don't offer the other side, which is we'll meet with you anytime, any place, to really address this issue, which is a concern to international peace and security. And all we ask is that you not have another test while we're doing that. You know, something simple and straightforward.
Let me answer the question this way. I think that now that if, you know, we in fact confirm that a test was a nuclear test, and I think we will, we have to realize that it's sort of a different world. And I think we have to realize that rollback, in other words, getting rid of those weapons, are going to be incredibly difficult now. I think there's a dynamic that occurs when countries, individuals, and systems invest so much money and resources, as the North Koreans have, into their weapons program, for them to say, okay, we'll give it up. It's going to take an incredible amount. So I think we're going to have to adjust expectations, and that causes me great concern because, you know, one of the things on the proliferation side is the best proliferator is never to produce the plutonium to begin with, and now they're constantly producing the plutonium. I think the initial instincts of this administration is having some kind of penalty or sanction for the test absolutely makes sense. It should be tough, but it's got to be smart. I think the harder part, besides the sanctions, is making sure it's coordinated, because without South Korea and China on board, and there was some discussion today that China wasn't quite on board, the sanctions aren't really going to amount to anything. So a coordinated approach is going to be absolutely necessary. My hope is that there's going to be a bilateral component to this, and I think there's a lot of discussion about that. Whether it's in the six-party context or not, I think we have to start talking with the North Koreans in a serious manner. And I also hope that what I call the partisan sniping that has come about these past few days will die down. I think that this issue is so important and has such long-range ramifications for the United States security that people have to come together. And ultimately, what we have to realize is that this administration is going to need a lot of help over the next 2 years, and that help has got to come from the other side.
Amy, you mentioned smart sanctions, and I think we ought to explore this just a little bit further. Smart sanctions have to do with interdicting materials that would be useful for weapons of mass destruction, as opposed to general trade sanctions or economic sanctions. Could you flesh that out a little more? And then I know Philip has some thoughts about whether smart sanctions, in fact, would be very difficult to enforce and very onerous economically for the North Koreans.
Well, smart sanctions have become an approach that I think has become more popular in the last several years, because there was a recognition that general sanctions just don't have much effect in a way. They don't get fully implemented. Most countries don't feel comfortable having a broad sweep of sanctions. So what's happened is trying to see if you can focus or target your efforts so that you really prevent a country from getting access to either the technology or the resources they need, or to prevent them from perhaps selling some of the things that would come out of these military capabilities. Also, sometimes it can actually have some impact on financial flows can be targeted that should be specifically related to, in this case, weapons of mass destruction, or possibly the travel of scientists or experts to or from, let's say, North Korea. The problem, and I think Philip and I agree with this, is actually being able to fine-tune a sanctions regime to really be able to sort of just pick off that, you know, small component of a country's economic activity, and also to get all the players you need to be involved to really abide by it. And then your end result is you end up sanctioning the countries that don't abide by it, which is sort of getting a little removed from what your ultimate objective is. So,
Philip?
I think in theory it makes a lot of sense, and as Amy's talking about, implementation is really hard. We have to think about what sanctions' purpose is. One is to punish. One is to hopefully, ultimately, in the end, change policy. And I'm not sure that, for example, the financial sanctions that just that were implemented or implemented back in December 2005 on banking transactions, clear that it had the desired effect of stopping banking transactions. I mean, most of the banks just decide it's not worth it to deal with North Korea, even though they weren't sure whether something was specifically related to missiles or not. or weapons or not. It's anecdotal evidence shows that the elite are very have been very uncomfortable and have been impacted by that. Now, whether that has changed policy or not, you know, the missile test and the nuclear test, I think, speaks for itself in certain ways. I also am concerned on asking the other question, because even though in theory it makes sense, the implementation, if you overstep, you're also kind of creating what I think is really your worst nightmare. You're increasing the incentive. If you're cutting off their basic way of survival in certain ways, what happens is that you're increasing the incentive, I believe, for the North Koreans to, or someone who has access, not necessarily the North Korean government, but someone who has access to the plutonium, to sell or transfer that. If someone like Osama bin Laden or a terrorist group comes up and says, we'll give you $10 million for a piece of plutonium, and you're desperate and your family is in really bad shape, what are you going to do? And so we have to be wary of that. The other piece of that, though, has to do with how effective the sanctions are, the interdiction is going to be. I mean, you're talking about several hundred miles of coastline, as well as a huge border in China. You're talking about a regime that has been very good at doing illicit activities that have not been detectable. And so for what you're trying to do is interdict a piece of a plutonium, weapons-grade plutonium, volleyball size or something like that, and it has to be 100% effective. It can't be 99.9% effective. It has to be 100% effective. And once it gets out, the game's up. So those are my reservations that we have to really think through.
All the same, my feeling is every country should be doing that anyway, because trafficking in plutonium and so on is not a good thing,
right.
North Korea or elsewhere. But I'll just leave that as a side comment.
Yeah, and I mean, in light of that, there are technologies you can put at the border and things like that that we've been doing with the former Soviet Union in many contexts to help them, I think, prevent some concerns about the security of their fissile material. There's no reason you couldn't do some of that. Even if it's not fully effective, it may end up as at least some indication that this is a serious activity and that even the Chinese are willing to work with the Americans on tightening their border controls. And it would be as much a symbolic act as anything. Yeah.
So South Korea has had a policy that they call the Sunshine Policy, which they believe can lead to change in North Korea. Philip or Amy, do you want to talk a little bit about the Sunshine Policy? Has it had results? Do you see that as an approach that would bear fruit with North Korea?
I'm definitely not a South Korean expert, but my own sense is that I thought that was a good approach, although I think they may have been a little overly eager to sort of bend over backwards in face of some of the North Korean activities, and it'll be interesting to see if in the current context there's pressure to sort of put a hold on some of the assistance that's been going forward and some of the collaboration in, I guess, the trade area. They have a economic area that they've been trying to help develop for the North Koreans. And I could imagine that those would make sense at this point to at least for some period of time to just sort of limit South Korean participation in and do a review of the Sunshine Policy. Even if it ends up being what they want to do, it gives a certain recognition that North Korea has crossed a line of sorts and there needs to be at least a momentary pause in whether this current policy makes ongoing sense.
Yeah, I think basically the Sunshine Policy is just all-out engagement with North Korea, and I think the philosophy of it makes a lot of sense. I think Kim Dae-jung put a lot of thought into that. Again, it all comes down to implementation, execution, and I think it has been somewhat flawed, but that doesn't mean you throw the whole thing out. I think that what is going to happen with the advent of the nuclear test, though, still remains to be seen. There are some people who are telling me that the engagement policy of some form will, at some point, will probably continue. There are other people who have told me that this nuclear test has really shaken up the psyche of South Korea in a way that it's hard to explain. Someone put it as drastic as, and I've not talked with enough people to make a good assessment of this, but they said it was their 9/11. That's the way he wanted to tell me how shaken up they were, and that this was going to, in fact, result in a very different kind of policy. If it allows us to be much more coordinated in what we do, I think that will be for the good. So something that is much more balanced, certainly I think is probably the most prudent way to go.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program, and our guests today are Dr. Amy Sands, Provost and Academic Vice President of the Monterey Institute of International Studies, former Assistant Director of the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, and Philip Yun, Vice President of the Asia Foundation and former Senior Advisor to the U.S. Coordinator for North Korea Policy. We have a great number of quite provocative questions from the audience, so I'm going to dive right into those, and there are a lot of them, so take your best shot. China is one of the very few countries that can exert significant pressure on North Korea. However, China is more concerned with North Korea completely collapsing. What should we expect from China at this point?
I think China will, in fact, endorse reasonably tough sanctions at the UN Security Council in the next couple days. I think they feel embarrassed by this nuclear test in a way that they're going to need to indicate that they are a responsible actor on the international context. They've been trying to play an increased role in different international activities, and I think they had thought they could really play a critical role in the whole negotiation process. And now that that whole process has almost collapsed in front of them, I think they're going to look for having a different kind of role. But when I say that they'll endorse a reasonably tough resolution at the UN Security Council, I don't think that means they'll go as far as the Bush administration wants them to go. I think they'll draw a line that will not quite have the sanctions to the degree that the Bush administration is trying to promote. And I suspect that they're having conversations with the North Koreans about how they can begin to engage in a different process. I actually hope they're having conversations with the Bush administration about how the Bush administration can start to engage in a slightly different approach to the North Koreans. Because the Chinese don't really believe sanctions is the answer. They don't believe there's a military answer here. They do believe that some form of diplomacy, probably over many years, is going to have to be the way to play this out. On the other hand, they don't want to see an arms race in Asia, because that will only impair their own security. So they have a large incentive, I think, to try to work this situation out in a way that contains the, I think, spillover effect of this nuclear test into the rest of Asia.
I think short-term China will probably respond to come closer to where the United States wants them to go. Over the longer term, I'm not sure. I think China has a number of policy goals. They want to avoid a North Korea collapse, as the question sort of assumes. They want to avoid a nuclear North Korea, and they want to avoid a conflict on the Korean Peninsula. Up to now, they've been trying to thread that needle. They've been trying to avoid making a choice. And it's interesting that they may be faced with this choice of, you know, which ones do they choose. And I think this is a challenge for the new, relatively new leadership of Hu Jintao. I think that China's influence, though, is overrated. I think that North Korea, in the way that the United States thinks that pressure, some people estimate 70% of their energy, 40% of their food, should be able to influence North Korea. But, the North Koreans have shown time and time and again they're fairly impervious to that kind of pressure. So I think the Chinese understand that. And I think that if, building on what Amy was talking about, if the U.S. policy is one, and I think there's some arguments that people say that the U.S. policy has basically relied up to now on China to solve the problem, which is to solve the nuclear issue, because of they're in the neighborhood, they would be most affected. I don't think that's going to work. But I do think Chinese pressure and policy can be effective perhaps with respect to another nuclear test that the North Koreans may be contemplating at some point, or another missile test in that fashion. In other words, a very focused sort of outcome in which we are hoping to avoid.
Let's talk about regime change for a second. Is there an internal challenge to the authority or power of Kim Jong-il? Is regime change possible? Is it desirable?
Well, I can answer that last question. I think it's an interesting issue when people say they want regime change, because you don't know what you're going to get. And if, in fact, regime change ends up with chaos and you do have this nuclear capability, who's in charge of it? I don't think we have a good sense of the stewardship of their nuclear capabilities and knowledge. So I'd be a little concerned having North Korea fall apart at this point, just the same concerns we've had with Pakistan in the past and other countries. So I'm not sure regime change is quite what you want unless you can really know who the next power to take over is going to be, and that I don't know much about. So hopefully Philip can give us some insight there.
Amy brings out the exact question. I actually had written an article about that precise question. If one could guarantee that a new regime would be more favorable to us, or have a reasonably high percentage that would be the case, that might not be such a bad way to go about bringing about rollback of some kind or putting the nuclear problem under control. But there is a possibility that we have to consider and think through that actually a new regime that coming could be worse. And the reason I talk about that is because, you know, we always have the assumption that the younger generation, the people who are in the wings waiting, if they're particularly if they're younger, are more enlightened. Okay, and as we found in the Middle East and in other places, that's not necessarily the case. And I think that there's some argument that can be made that the generation that's waiting is actually a lot worse. If you think about it, the generation right now that's in waiting came into power and was born when there was only a North Korea, didn't understand Korea in a larger context. A lot of the contact that a lot of the older generation had was very close with Soviet generals as well as military, as well as the Chinese military. All those contacts have basically been gone for the last 20 years. So what I think is you have a generation in waiting that's probably has less contact with the outside world, may have bought into the propaganda that the North Koreans have perpetuated within their society of a amoral, weak West. And in fact, that this group of people are actually much more nationalistic, and if I can use the word, you know, it's so that people can understand, maybe more fundamental in a certain way. So I think that's something we really have to be concerned about, and not discount that.
You know, it seems to me that the South Korean government still has a cabinet post that includes Minister for Reunification. So I suppose regime change, some people would think, might mean that the government of the Korean Peninsula would be in Seoul. What do you think the prospects of that are? More a model like East Germany and West Germany, where the North would be absorbed by South Korea?
I suppose that is possible under certain contexts, but not in the current situation we're in. I don't see that, you know, that the integration of East and West Germany happened because the two sides finally agreed that was the timing, it was the right time, and even then there was a lot of problem. It wasn't that there was conflict necessarily, but it wasn't smooth. And it's still, I think, there's still aspects of the integration that I think, especially certain parts of Germany, the unified Germany, are probably not fully satisfied with. And that's a case where they wanted it to happen. If you're a situation where you've had a regime change because there's been a coup or there's been some sort of event that's caused the current leadership in North Korea to be removed, it doesn't seem to me that that's the kind of situation where the South Koreans can just assert their right to merge the two countries. I think you're looking at a huge conflict then on the Korean Peninsula, which would be pretty bloody and unpleasant.
When people talk about reunification, it depends what kind of timeline you're talking about. I think at this point right now, it seems pretty sure that the North Korean regime as it currently exists is not sustainable. The question is, for how long? And we don't know. It could be 5 years, 10 years. It could be, 50 years. But it's going to have to change in some fashion. The question is whether it's violent and quick, whether it's gradual or not. I cannot see and when you talk to South Koreans, I don't think they can, although they're willing to accept an interim sort of arrangement where both of them sort of remain sort of separate in certain ways, I don't think that Koreans in general will accept the idea of a permanently separated Korea. So at some point, something has got to give and has to change. But given over a long period of time, you think about it, well, I don't see South Koreans evolving or accepting a dictatorship or the North Korean system. So in the end, it's going to have to go the other way. So that's really my thoughts on that.
One related question. Certainly the debate, I'm old enough to remember when South Korea's nuclear program was an issue back in the 70s, and when the U.S. was pressuring South Korea and to move away from a prospective nuclear program. Do you think that that debate in South Korea has been reawakened, that they would now be looking at whether they should restart their nuclear weapons development program?
Well, that's the concern. The concern is that, as we know, Japan is all up in arms, which they deservedly should be. There's a concern that this nuclear test will trigger an arms race at some point in East Asia. I mean, if Japan becomes a declared nuclear power, then there's greater incentive, greater pressure, at least politically, in South Korea, and then there's the whole issue of Taiwan. And then when that happens, you've got China that comes in, so it's not a very good situation. And I don't think, and that's one of the major concerns that people who sort of look at this for a living were most concerned about, is that potential.
And I guess there was some poll, I think, already taken of the South Koreans indicating that there's an increased interest in the nuclear weapons option for South Korea. But I think that's a little soon to be talking about a upsurge of interest. And I guess I think what's going to happen in Asia is there's going to be a discussion about nuclear weapons in general. And you're going to see a lot of nationalist feelings and concern over the security umbrella that the U.S. has provided both to South Korea and to Japan. And if there's any sense that that's weakening, then that also will open the door to especially Japan looking at other options. But I think as long as the U.S. stands behind its current alliance system in Asia, I think we can sort of weather the interest in Asia for these other countries to have nuclear capability. Because in the long run, I think the Japanese know it's not in their interest to really have a nuclear weapons capability themselves, that they become a target, that they create this incredible tension with China and Russia, that it really won't increase their security. But it may take a dialogue and discussion within Japan to get through that. And that might not be such a bad thing to have, actually, because every so often it's good to remind yourself of why you don't want nuclear weapons.
Well, I think just to add, to me it's a question of U.S. leadership. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, probably one of the foremost reasons why I believe the United States has to remain engaged in Asia, because it's critical to our security and where we can play a role. I happen to think how we handle the North Korean question and all the side issues related to the proliferation issue, whether Japan decides to become a nuclear power or not, will determine whether or not U.S. engagement in Asia is needed, which has always been the presumption, or wanted. So this is not only about North Korea and the United States. It's really about the security architecture for all of Asia and the Asia-Pacific for some time to come.
So when we were planning this session, we planned, obviously, to talk about more than North Korea. And if you would have asked me 2 weeks ago, what was I more concerned about, proliferation when it came to North Korea or proliferation when it came to Iran, I would have said Iran. Iran is a country in the midst of the Middle East powder keg. Iran has oil money. Iran could be much more of a threat in terms of building a significant nuclear weapons capability. Let's broaden this discussion out and talk a little bit about other potential proliferators and, in fact, the impact of what North Korea has done on some of these other states. One question from the audience puts it this way. What about the idea that the North Korean test was less about military concerns and more a demonstration for prospective customers? Are we going to see North Korea trying to share this technology? What's the impact on Iran? What are the Iranians thinking? They have certainly been saying some very laudatory things about the North Koreans. What are the broader impacts of this with other potential proliferators?
Well, I think this is a situation where there do need to be some clear markers in the sand or red lines drawn in a sense of making it clear to the North Koreans now that they've crossed this threshold with a nuclear test that that should not mean that they suddenly open up a shop and start selling wares. And it has to be, I think, a pretty transparent and clear red line that's drawn in the sense, because there are other countries watching, because I think it has to be clear to the international community that it's bad enough for a country such as North Korea or Iran, or for that matter, I might even include the United States, to have nuclear weapons. But it'd be even more of a threat and challenge if they were, in fact, engaging in some sort of nuclear, whether it's black market activity or a very, transparent type of transactions in the nuclear area. And so I do think that's got to be very clearly stated. It has been a pretty clear, policy of the Bush administration, of almost every administration, that providing nuclear materials and especially fissile material to non-state actors or to potential proliferants is really something that's is not to be accepted and has to be dealt with. On the other hand, as we were talking earlier, trying to prevent that from actually happening is really very difficult, because countries can find all sorts of ways to get materials across their borders. And so it really is something that you can try to put up a variety of different mechanisms to deter, but in reality, if a group wants to sell a small amount of fissile material, they can probably manage it. Or if they want to set up a network like the Pakistani scientist A.Q. Khan did, that helps countries develop enrichment or reprocessing capabilities, they can probably do it, although not easily and not as smoothly as I think that has been in the past, because there now are so many barriers to that happening. I am concerned, I think, how this plays out in terms of what Iran is keeping, sort of a close watch on how North Korea is dealt with. But I would say that I think I always thought North Korea was the greater concern, because we had less time. We knew they had fissile material. It wasn't clear whether they'd gone to the point of weaponizing it. It wasn't clear how much material they had. But we knew they already had it. Whereas with the Iran case, we actually have a couple years here before they probably even have it. And so I thought that given the regime in North Korea and the fact that the negotiation seems to have collapsed, that we were already down a path that had a lot of problems and challenges to it. So even before the test, I think I was more concerned, and have always been curious by the Bush administration's willingness to let this basically wander almost off its agenda in so many ways that it hasn't gotten the attention it needed.
The short answer is I think everybody's watching. I think with respect to the missiles specifically, I think I would completely agree that it was sort of the missile tests, which the missile tests that occurred over the summer were actually seven tests, I believe. There were six short-term, short-range missiles that went off, and then a long-term Taepodong. The short-range missiles were all done in sequence, perfect telemetry. Part of it had to do with them making sure that the design was okay, but I think there's a pretty good argument that they were showing everybody that they still can do it, and they can do it very well, and they succeeded in that. I can tell you that I think people think that those particular tests were quite successful. And we all know that with respect to missile technology, the North Koreans have been using that as sort of one of their cash cows. I think there is a harder argument to be made with respect to nuclear material. I hope that, and I would have to believe that the Bush administration to the North Koreans have been very clear about this particular red line. And so I am not as concerned about that, at least in the short term. I think that definitely you can't discount the possibility that there may be at some point in the future, though, a business arrangement, so to speak, between Iran and North Korea if things for North Korea get bad enough. And so in my view, the thing is don't make it so bad that they consider doing something like that and think it through more than anything else. I also agree with Amy that in the short term, I think North Korea has always been the bigger problem than as opposed to Iran. However, on the longer term, I wonder if Iran actually may be more of a problem. It depends on which how you look at it. If you look at it in terms of intent, capability, and the X factor, okay, what I call the X factor, capability-wise, definitely North Korea. Intent, I don't think North Korea right now has a view to to change the world or to change the fundamental way this the West operates. I don't know. I'm not an expert on Iran, but the fundamentalist movement and what Iran is doing in terms of their funding, there is a larger sort of agenda here with respect to the Middle East and the West. And I think in that sense is probably more dangerous than North Korea. North Korea, for right now, is just trying to survive. That's my belief. The X factor, though, happens to do with the collapse or the loose nukes situation. If North Korea, for some reason, something does happen, then you've got this fissile material that's already been produced, that is already exists, that you can't get rid of, and who controls it? And then, and if no one's controlling it, who's going to get it? And that's a real problem.
So let's talk about the non-proliferation regime. There, as you know, has been a set of treaties and export controls and practices in place seeking to stop the spread of nuclear weapons. Is this regime in tatters at this point? In the 1998, we saw Pakistan test a nuclear weapon. Now North Korea, Iran seems to be on that path. Has that regime successfully stopped any country in recent times that wanted to pursue nuclear weapons?
In recent times, if you're talking about the last 4 or 5 years, no. I'm just trying to think. Oh, well, Libya, actually. But the regime didn't, in fact, stop it. I think it was a combination of years of diplomacy, change in perspective of the leadership in Libya. In fact, the younger generation there did make a positive impact, I think, on the leadership there. Some interdiction by the U.S., well-timed to embarrass the Libyans. Economic situations in Libya that caused them to want to be reintegrated into the broader international economic community. So it wasn't really the regime itself that had sort of succeeded, I think, but it did prevent, I think, them moving in and gave them an umbrella on which to come back into the fold. I do think we're on the verge of having the nuclear non-proliferation regime specifically in tatters, and it's sort of considered the cornerstone of the overall non-proliferation set of treaties and activities. And so as it begins to really fall apart, it begins to, I think, undermine other treaties that have to do with chemical and biological weapons. I think it's been unfortunate that the Bush administration has taken an attitude to that specific treaty that has not helped to strengthen it. They've done a lot of things in other multilateral contexts, but not in ways that have strengthened that treaty. They walked away from some commitments from earlier administrations. They have not been willing to really send what were, I think, quite the quality of delegations to different discussions that involve the treaty, which is another way of not showing a lot of respect for it. And so they clearly haven't been giving it, I think, the attention and the resources it needs to be nurtured. On the other hand, they have done some very good things that are sort of on the margins of the treaty that have to do with interdiction, with strengthening, I think, domestic laws that have to do with export controls, with trying to create a stronger International Atomic Energy Agency in certain ways. But it hasn't been ones that have really dealt, have helped to build the international frame of reference that you need. They've been targeted activities, mostly in the interest of the United States concerns. And that's not how you build an international support structure. So I think we are at the edge of losing that overall framework. I don't think it's lost yet, and so I'm still hopeful that we may be able to resurrect it in certain ways.
Let me. I'm not going to contradict Amy in any way. I think I completely agree with what she has said. One of the things that I wanted to sort of just maybe highlight is the fact that North Korea. Why it's unfortunate that North Korea was permitted, or it was we acquiesced to them withdrawing from the NPT. And my correct me if I'm wrong. They're the only country that's been able. That has done that. And I think that that is why in 1994 the U.S. government at that time paid so much attention to their suspension of NPT and their supposed withdrawal and made sure that as part of the great framework that they re-entered IAEA inspectors, international inspectors, according to that treaty were allowed to come back in. And so, again, I think the fact that this was a precedent that North Korea established, which does not bode well.
So then, if that regime is fraying, and if we're seeing more members of the nuclear club on the horizon, what then? One person from the audience says, if deterrence worked for the Cold War, why do we not believe it will work for North Korea or Iran? In other words, what about a nuclearized world? Where a number of countries have nuclear weapons, is it likely to be more dangerous?
I think it would be more dangerous. I think we were lucky in the Cold War, especially in the first 10 to 15 years, that we didn't have the use of nuclear weapons. Deterrence wasn't really active, I think, until the 60s in a meaningful way. And so what you might have is, in fact, a decade or so where countries are just learning about what it means to have nuclear capabilities and how to structure their own policy, their military posture, their stewardship of these capabilities, the security around them. And it's a time when you can have a lot of mistakes in those things, miscommunications, and people, I think, underestimate what can happen when the nuclear weapons are not, I think, recognized to be the force they are. I'm a little concerned that the memory of Hiroshima and Nagasaki sort of fading as we get further and further away from it, and people seem to be more willing to talk about potential use of these capabilities. And when you look at the 1950s, it was an interesting time when the U.S. actually brandished these about a bit in a way that was problematic, but the history shows that both Truman and Eisenhower actually thought about uses of these of nuclear weapons in different contexts. They backed off for a variety of reasons in each case, thank heaven. But what we can't afford is having a nuclear-armed North Korea talking about it or doing something that might cause Japan to then become concerned enough that they would, in fact, become a nuclear-capable country. And then you would then have Russia, Japan, North Korea, potentially then South Korea might feel the need, and China all sitting on each other's borders. Remember, we were a long way away from the Soviet Union when we had deterrence. Sitting on each other's borders is not, I think, conducive to not having small conflicts that can end up into some horrendous situations, which is why the concern between India and Pakistan exists. They have an ongoing conflict. They have gotten to the brink of actually threatening to use nuclear weapons. We can't have that in every context that we have these antagonistic and historic rivalries, and that's where we're heading at this point. So the concept of having a lot of nuclear-armed countries as being a stable context, I think, is just not realistic and is not a world that I think would be one we'd all want to live in.
Well, it was tough during the Cold War, where basically you had a bipolar sort of circumstance, Soviet Union and the United States. What we're talking about now is a multipolar circumstance, at least the hypothetical here. That's an entirely different circumstance. I mean, there's an incredible amount of literature that was devoted to nuclear deterrence, games theory on a bipolar sort of circumstance. Multipolar, you know, states still, you know, it's not been fully explored, I think, in ways, in practical matter. So I think it does increase, as Amy say, the chances of miscalculation. I also happen to think that, a question assumes that you have perfect control over all of this material. Again, I have to say is once this material is produced, plutonium has a half-life of something like 20,000 years. You just can't throw it away. It has to be secured. It has to be secured for a very, very long time. And that presumes a lot in terms of the state that's in control of that. And so, therefore, what you've done is, even though, the question assumes that it's somewhat stable, you have this possibility that material will get out. And you've got a lot of people right now who'd be willing to pay a lot of money for that material. And, again, that's not the kind of world I want to live in.
So if there's still a strong incentive to stop this trend towards a more broadly nuclearized world, talking about North Korea and Iran, what should the U.S. be doing? What should we be trying for? What tactics should we be trying? What would you do if you were Secretary of State?
I would pursue an approach with the UN Security Council in the case of North Korea, as I think we are doing, but I would try to find something that would create a very strong consensus resolution, and not one that caused some sort of friction with the Chinese or the South Koreans. So it probably isn't as tough of sanctions as they might have, as the current Bush administration might want. But at the same time, I think I would be trying to find a way to engage the North Koreans. And I guess I would say to the world, in a way that was sincere, sounded sincere, that was humble, that said, we realize we have these capabilities. We realize that we're probably the strongest military power at the moment in the world. And we're concerned that somehow that's causing security concerns, and we want to engage other countries about that sort of concern. Let's sit down and talk to Iran. Let's sit down and talk to the North Koreans in a way that addresses their security concerns. And whether it's bilateral or multilateral, I don't think is the issue. I think in both cases, those countries want bilateral discussions. I don't see any reason not to do that. We did it with the Soviet Union. We've done it with the Chinese. We did it with the North Vietnamese. At this point in time, I think it's important for the U.S. to show that it's incredibly, itself secure with what it has and who it is in the world, instead of somehow having an arrogance that really makes it very hard for countries to engage us. So I think we need to take a first step forward, but it's got to be in the context of some sanctions that actually do indicate sort of the international community's real concern over the actions of North Korea.
Let me put this maybe in the context of North Korea. If we can be successful in putting North Korea nuclear weapons program, I think that will do a lot for proliferation, non-proliferation efforts worldwide. And that should be right now our continuing focus. I've talked about the notion of working to create a bipartisan consensus. I think that's important. I think that we do have to have some kind of discussion in a bilateral context, and I'm perfectly willing, and I think it makes sense to do it in the six party if that's still a feasible and viable forum to do that. I think we should try to seek at this point a freeze, somehow try to limit the current production that's going on at the Yongbyon plant in some way. And I think another piece of this that Amy is also alluding to is the whole notion of making clear what our policy is. And as reprehensible as the North Korean regime is, I'll be the first one to say that. There are certain realities is that we can't, we don't really have any leverage to make them go away. We have to accept who they are and deal with it. And in that context, I think our highest priority should be the plutonium. First things first, and therefore we should make clear that regime change for the time being is not our priority, and then move forward. In terms of the substantive flexibility, talking about the pieces are all there. It's not really, a lot of smart people have been thinking very long as to what it would take to put a deal together, and I think they're there. The question is whether or not we can generate a positive dynamic which does not exist right now, instead of the negative or downward spiral that seems to be occurring at this point.
Well, we've come to the end of our program. I'd like to thank our audience for a number of extremely good questions. And one last question for each of the panelists. If you could do one thing tomorrow to positively affect the trend towards proliferation, what would it be?
We haven't talked about this at all, but I would argue that the U.S. has to lessen the salience of nuclear weapons in its own military strategy as a first step towards getting other countries to see that there's not value in having these capabilities.
Philip?
Again, I'll talk in the North Korean context. I think that after a suitable period of time, the best thing that we can do is be willing at least to have a discussion with North Korea in terms of what their concerns are, and to determine once and for all whether they're willing to give up their nuclear weapons program, which to this point I could argue we have not really done fully, and then make a decision where to go from there.
Our thanks to Dr. Amy Sands, Provost and Academic Vice President of the Monterey Institute of International Studies, former Assistant Director of the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, and to Philip Yun, Vice President of the Asia Foundation and former Senior Advisor to the U.S. Coordinator for North Korea Policy. I'd like to mention again that tonight's program has been co-sponsored by Women in International Security. Thank you to our audience here. Thank you to our audience out on the radio. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating over a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.